Beautiful, sunny, but chilly day here in Park City. I'm Doug Wells. Larry Warren is on vacation in Paris still this week. Larry, hope you're having fun. I have a special guest co-host with me today, Ted McAleer. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Doug. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Ted is the executive director of U-Star. He'll tell us more about that at the end of the program. We've got a full day, Ted. We've got a speaker today on leadership, Erica Ariel Fox. She attended and graduated from Harvard Law School. She currently teaches negotiations at Harvard Law School. And if you've ever wanted a Harvard education, this is your chance to get 10 or 15 minutes of that. Erica is going to talk to us about her new book, which is called Winning from Within, and it talks about negotiations and it talks about leadership in a very special style, which is kind of our negotiations with ourselves, and we'll learn more about that in a few minutes.
Sounds like a great guest. Well, our second and third guests are also really interesting. Our second guest this morning will be Susan McTiernan, who's the Associate Dean for Graduate Programs in the Quinnipiac University School of Business. And the focus of that conversation will be about the nomination of Janet Yellen for to be the first woman to chair the Federal Reserve to replace Ben Bernanke. Should be a very interesting conversation. Looking forward to that. And then we'll wrap up this morning with a couple of our local friends here from the Fresh Day Cafe at Rite Aid. Kristen Zuger and Alicia Morin have been kind of leading the effort at Rite Aid to make it a more friendly, welcoming place. And we look forward to hearing more about what they've got to go. So I think that takes us to the break.
It does. And speaking of which, you want to stay tuned. We'll be back from a break in a minute. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW. Stay tuned, please.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
KPCW is proud once again to recognize the great work of its on-air hosts, who were honored this week at the 2013 Utah Broadcasters Association UBE Awards for Radio Program Excellence. Congratulations to Jan Williams, John Burdick, Larry Warren, Doug Wells, Nell Larson, Chris Cherniak, John Wells, Lynn Ware Peak, and Tim Henney for their success and the recognition they received from their peers. Only in Park City, only on KPCW. Now fortified with gold, silver, and bronze.
Welcome back to Mound Money. On the air with us now on the phone, we have Erica Ariel Fox. She is a graduate of Harvard Law School. She's now teaching at the Harvard Law School. She teaches at the Negotiation and Leadership Center there. Erica Ariel Fox, she's the author of Winning from Within. Erica, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. Congratulations on your award.
Congratulations on what?
They just announced that you all won an award.
Oh, are we UBE winners? I
yes.
Guess we are. All right. Well,
yes.
UBE award-winning Mound Money. You heard it here first, and I heard it here first, apparently, as well.
Well, maybe I wasn't the person to be the messenger, but, you know, they announced it. It kind of felt like a big deal.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you. It is appropriate that you gave me that message.
Thanks for having me on the program.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us. So, Ariel, we have a lot of authors on our program. It's kind of the format that we do. The first guest is usually a best-selling author.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I have time to read the entire book, and sometimes I don't. I had some airplane time this weekend, so I actually did have time to read your entire book.
Oh, nice. Thank you.
Yeah, it was very interesting, very helpful. And where I wanted to start is, can you share with us, it's kind of an unusual title, Winning from Within. We think of winning being an external thing.
Exactly.
But I think it's descriptive of your book. Can you start there? Why is it called Winning from Within?
Yeah, I mean, negotiation is something that we all do all the time. We do it all day long. But when people think about negotiation, they tend to focus on their experience with other people. So if you're trying to buy a car, you see yourself negotiating with the dealer. If you're trying to sell your house, if you're negotiating with your boss to try to get a raise, and people put a lot of focus on the other side across the table, and they worry, will these be difficult people or hard bargainers or irrational people? but they put remarkably little attention on themselves and their own internal experience, their fears, their mindsets, their worries, their aspirations, which at the end of the day have a larger influence on the ultimate impact. And it's also something you have a lot more control over. You can develop your own internal capability. You can't necessarily wave a magic wand and make other people behave differently than they do. So the book is really saying, for now, you know, let's look a little bit less at what everybody else is doing and focus on a basic idea that really the most important negotiations you have daily and across the course of your life are really the negotiations you have with yourself.
Well, it is an interesting read, and I spent a little time in Cambridge myself back in the 98-99 time. I remember the book
Getting to Yes, and I see that your mentor actually was the original author of Getting to Yes, and I also remember Avoiding No. Where do you think that this new book is going to take executives or people that lead negotiations? What are you hoping that they're going to pick up on that they might have missed in getting to yes and avoiding no?
Well, I think you're starting in just the right point because, in a way, this book is building on that lineage very precisely, not in the sense that 30 years ago there was a vision of a series, but looking back, you can see how these ideas evolved and built on each other. So Getting to Yes, which is a very well-known, extremely well-respected book, and created a conventional wisdom around the world around so-called win-win negotiation, had a bunch of principles in it. And one of the most famous ones is the idea that you should separate the people from the problem. You may be familiar with this principle yourself. And it really meant, if instead of thinking that you're my enemy or I'm against you, you know, can't we step to the same side and together face this problem?
And one of the things, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just was going to tell you a very quick story that you know, we shared those ideas with a lot of people, but had a lot of different kinds of audiences coming back and saying, I love that idea, but I can't separate the people from the problem, because in my case, the people are my problem, right? It is my boss, or it is my cousin, or it is my teenager, and I can't separate the people from the problem, and difficult conversations and getting past no, and these books you've referenced, these books came out to address what people should do when they feel like other people are their problem. And over the course of the last 10 years, 15 years, just to answer your question, this book is really coming to ask what I think is a very natural next question, which is not separating the people from the problem or addressing when other people are the problem, but what if I am the problem? What if I am actually the problem? So I'm the CEO, and it's easier for me to point fingers and blame and say these executives are not taking accountability or not delivering. But what role are you playing, CEO, in creating those dynamics? It's a thing of really pointing people back to themselves.
And that's really the power, I think, of your book, is what if you yourself are the problem?
Right? Exactly.
And that dynamic is really challenging, right? Because first you have to, you give an example of a sales rep, Giovanna, in your book. And I think it illustrates the point, which is first, you have to be receptive to that feedback. Now, let's say you are receptive, which is a very difficult thing to do, and say, okay, I'm going to take this as constructive. Yes, I do struggle with that issue. Now, what a lot of people have a challenge with is, what do I do about that? How do I balance that? How do I make it work? And some people are fortunate enough that they can hire an executive coach. You, Erica, have worked as an executive coach with many people. I ran a company very early in my career, probably too soon in my career. And so I had some areas I needed to shore up. And fortunately for me, I was offered the chance to work with an executive coach, and it was tremendously helpful. But a lot of people don't have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. So kind of lay out the framework. Let's say you have a client that is willing to receive that feedback, does recognize it's something that they need to work on. What's that framework? Share with our audience a framework in your book to help them with that issue.
Yeah. Well, I certainly agree with you that if you have the opportunity and the resources to have one on coach working with you over time, you know, that's a very high impact way to foster your own development. And like you said, many people don't have access to that kind of resource. So the focus of this framework is on four inner negotiators And my experience in working with people in very short workshops, 2 days and 3 days, you know, not a 6-month coaching engagement, and having them read parts of the book, is that when they get their minds around these sort of big four inner negotiators inside of themselves, they can work with them pretty easily to start seeing new results. And I can give you a few examples. I mean, basically, the truth is you have many, many negotiators inside of you, many voices pulling you here, pulling you there. But I talk about the big four because I've seen them come up in so many different traditions in so many places in the world, and they're helpful for business people because I describe them as your sort of inner top team. And I think people can understand that they have a sort of inner CEO, which is their dreamer or their visionary part of themselves, an inner CFO, chief financial officer, who's the thinker, more analytical, focusing on facts and information, the chief operating officer or warrior who takes action, wants to make sure things are getting done efficiently and on time, and then the VP of HR, who focuses on people and relationships. You would see those four people on a corporate top team. You also have those four characters inside of yourself. So a way that you can work on this yourself without an external help, without a training or a coach, is to start looking at where your natural tendencies. Are you more comfortable in the visionary, dreamer? You know, this is true of many entrepreneurs, people who start small businesses, often very strong, but are you therefore less strong in the practical constraints and realities that the warrior faces? Do you tend to think more and not develop deep relationships, or perhaps you're good at building deep, trusting relationships and advisory relationships with clients, but they don't think that your analysis is rigorous enough? So once you get a sense of where your strengths are, then you know these. Then you know nobody's strong in all four at the same time. So figure out where your strengths are, figure out where your developmental opportunities are, and then start doing some practice.
You know, this seems like a book that all executives should be reading, and we all know that there's a lot of best practice books that get introduced, particularly through Harvard Business School Press and Harvard University Press. I'm curious what your experience has been since you've rolled this out, Erica. How are you using maybe social media or other things to really push this book out there, and what kind of reception have you had since you've been rolling it out?
The response has been phenomenal, and I think it's partially because it's the right set of ideas at the right time. I think, you know, the external world is a very uncertain and ambiguous and frightening place, and saying to people, you can also look within yourself.
Yeah,
so an anchor, right, and an orientation is helping people, and I would guess that's part of why the book has had such a strong response.
Yeah, it's interesting, Erica. You know, Doug and myself both understand the four roles that you've outlined, and it's easy to think about the applicability to business. We've got another struggle going on right now in Washington, D.C. Is there any chance that you might be able to take this book to D.C. and do some seminars? Because how do you use the framework to explain what's going on with the left and the right?
What I would say in terms of the big four is what we've been seeing there can also happen to all of us. You know, if you get really over-identified with one of the big four, and in this case we might say the warrior, for example. You know, the warrior is a fighter, and he or she knows what they believe in. They're going to take a stand. They're going to hold their ground, and they experience that they're speaking the truth. And, you know, there's some honor in that, you know, taking a stand. But when you get over-identified with one at the expense of the others, you see breakdowns. And it's interesting because some people are talking about the way that the 20 women in the Senate who came together had a very different orientation to each other as a group. They were, in my view, much more identified with the lover archetype. They put their own relationships ahead of the policy at the outset, established that they wouldn't say anything negative about each other in the press. Right? So it's a very different identification from the warrior archetype to the lover archetype. And it was drafts of policy recommendations, therefore coming from the thinker, you know, to get on the table, but coming from the group that was approaching it from a people focus. Let's start by establishing civility and respect in our communication and our relationships. That group was able to stimulate progress on the policy front where, you know, having your dukes out and punching and criticizing and in the press, at, you know, 24 hours a day news cycle wasn't getting us anywhere. So, and all of that, I say, can happen to any of us. We can get really identified in our lover and fight for a relationship and stay in it way too long. And we look back and think, you know, if my thinker had really been clear and looked at the situation, my thinker might have said, whether it's a business partnership or a marriage, you know, this relationship really hasn't been working for a long, long time. But I've been pushing my thinker away and only focusing on my lover. So all of that is to say, really effective leaders, you know, a healthy life, healthy marriage, parenting, really does come from an effective balance and the ability to feel comfortable. I can use my dreamer, my thinker, my lover, my warrior at the right time for the right purpose. I mean, when you are starting to sense you've really identified with one at the expense of everything else, you are going to get in trouble. And I think that is really what we've seen in Washington.
Well, and that's one of the things I like about your framework, right? First, it points out how important it is. And Ted, your question on what's going on in D.C. just illustrates how important this question about negotiations are and how important it is in a business setting and also from a policy setting that we learn to negotiate positive way and a constructive way as opposed to a destructive way. Erica, one of the things I like about your framework too is I'm at the stage in my career now where I do a fair amount of mentoring and coaching of other folks as they're trying to make important decisions in their life or get more effective at what they're doing. And one of the things I hear often as I get to know somebody and they become more candid is just this struggling with making a decision. Something's really good for their career, but their kids are about to enter high school.
You bet.
And they don't know, should they move the family? And what I tell them is it's very normal to struggle with this. But what I like about your framework is it gives me a way to illustrate why it is so normal. And the reality is people are struggling within themselves between different values that are very important and trying to balance them. So I love that framework. Let's get back to the example because I think all of us want to be more effective at work and at home. Let's go back to the example where you get feedback, you know you want to work on it, and then how do you do that? Let's say you know you've been driving too hard at work for a while, and you're that warrior aspect of things. How do you keep the positive sides of that warrior, not give it up entirely? But then also bring in the other areas and de-emphasize the warrior. How does somebody do that?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic. You know, if you think about a seesaw on the playground and one end of it is sticking all the way in the air, if you start putting a little bit of pressure on one side, putting it down, by definition, the other side's going to start to come up. Does that make sense?
It does, yes.
So a lot of times, you don't have to work both sides of your problem or your challenge, because as you're working one side, the other will naturally fall in line. So if you're thinking you're overinflated warrior, you're overdrive, you're working too hard, and you want to raise, let's say, your relationships or paying attention to your family or your community, your friends, if you put your focus on the relationship building and really pay more attention to your inner lover, it will happen very naturally and organically that the warrior will start to, I don't want to say deflate, but it will start to come back down to size. It will right size. As you're raising one, another one will come back to center.
That's hopeful because it's not as daunting as I think a lot. And that's been my life experience as well. As you kind of focus on the other areas that are important, you de-emphasize it, just
exactly
naturally starts
natural
to
process.
Get better.
Yes.
It may not get, you know, it may never be your strength, but it does tend to get better.
Yeah. And I think I give that advice a lot to people, which is it does seem to be easier to tackle something you don't use very much at all and really start experimenting. Start paying attention to other people in your office or people in your life who are very good at that quarter that you're trying to build up in yourself. You know, pay attention. What are their mindsets? What do you see them doing or not doing? What are they saying differently than how you would say it? And as you really start to just build some muscles, build some capability in that area, it will very naturally happen that less of your attention and less of your capacity is going to the part you was inflated before. And it's easier for most people to do that than to directly, you know, go to the part of themselves that may be very inflated and, quote-unquote, try to bring it down. So you can do it, but my advice often is to people, you know, focus on the areas that you use much less and probably aren't as good at, but start building capability there. And ultimately, you do want to have a sense of center, not necessarily a sense of perfect balance at every moment, but a sense of harmony between them, that they're not at odds with each other.
Yeah, so in essence, you know, there's a lot of personal change management that folks can learn from this book. I'm curious, we know the folks on the other side of the Charles River from you over at the Harvard Business School sometimes take a while to incorporate new curriculum into their courses. Has this been incorporated yet into the negotiation course over at the Harvard Business School?
I'll tell you something funny. You know, I spend an enormous amount of time with business people. Not as much time at the business school, but with executives and top teams and leaders. And I do know a fair amount of lawyers. And I'll tell you that there's a huge openness in the business community, a huge readiness to really look at a new way of developing leaders or top leaders developing themselves, because there's not that much for senior leaders right now, to do real deep internal work that creates results and measurable outcomes. Much more willingness and interest and curiosity, openness from the business community than law firms and lawyers and the bar association. I think that the business community is far ahead. And although, of course, this model developed at Harvard Law School, I don't think that the legal profession has followed, and it may not be taught at the business school, but the business community is really, you know, is really engaging this material all over the world.
It's an interesting point, right? I work with a lot of law firms, and they have a very different culture than most non-law firm businesses. And it is a very
about learning.
Driven. Yeah, it's a very, you have examples in your book about your experiences as an attorney as well, and it is a very driven culture. So that's an interesting point that you bring out, that this was brought out at the law school.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some interesting nuggets towards the end of the book that I want to give you a chance to chat about. One is I want you to tell us about your experience meeting President Barack Obama. But, but before you do that, you've got a quote in your book that, as a father of two daughters, I found disturbing. It's from the ex-president of Harvard. And what many of the person that many folks thought was going to be our next Fed chief. We've got a guest, Ted, coming on next that's going to talk about Janet Yellen, who, as we all know, was nominated recently by President Obama. But you talk about the consequences of, you know, thinking your thinker side and thinking through the consequences before you say something. Briefly tell us the story of Larry Summers, and then I want to hear about your chance to meet the president.
Well, you know, I think Larry Summers, throughout his career, has had opportunities of shining brilliance and then moments where, for whatever sets of reasons, he really gets in his own way. And I do believe that this incident that you're talking about that was in the book is probably part of, not exclusively, but part of why he ended up taking his name out of the nomination process. And in essence, he came to speak at a conference that was looking at the question of why we don't have more women and minority groups represented in the sciences, professionally, in engineering and in the sciences. And he gave a talk which, perhaps his words were twisted, I wasn't there, but certainly many, many people who were there reported him to have said a theory that girls, and therefore women, are just genetically inferior to boys and men, and quite possibly the reason we have fewer women in sciences and engineering is just because women, girls and women are innately genetically incapable of competing with boys and men. It's not a level playing field. Now, to say that in a university setting has a deep aspiration to cultivate diversity in the learning environment and, you know, to empower and validate everyone's opportunity to fulfill their highest potential, to start saying half the population is just innately genetically incapable of competing, as president of a university, probably wasn't his most shining moment. And, you know, Larry likes to be a provocateur, so we never will know whether he said that because, you know, there's sort of a whimsical way of shaking things up and rocking the boat. But in general, the point I'm making that you're referring to is that one of the ways that the inner thinker helps us is by trying to anticipate and think through consequences. And, you know, there are different parts in the Big Four, like the dreamer who has a big dream and wants to go fulfill it, can really be balanced by the thinker saying, well, I love your dream, but can we crunch the numbers and just make sure we can afford this? I mean, I'm not against your dream. I just don't want us to go bankrupt. And or all different kinds of variations of that. And the thinker taking the time carefully and patiently to prepare and think about consequences, you know, unless in this case he was having fun and that there was a way he wanted some of those consequences, I would say that probably wasn't the most well thought out speech.
Well, if that's his idea of fun, I'd hate to see what vacation looks like.
I'm just saying, right. You know, of course, created an enormous firestorm that eventually cost him the presidency of Harvard. So, yeah.
So on a more positive note, and the one that we need to wrap up on, tell us about your chance to meet with the president.
That was just such an honor and such a memorable evening. You talked about coaching earlier in the program and the benefit of coaching. And one of the things that my colleagues and I at the company I work with called Mobius had done was provide a lot of coaching services to people in the field offices working for the Obama committee to reelect the president. So we had formed a lot of relationships with the field offices and you know, with the inner team, and then we got invited to this event, you know, in appreciation for our providing these coaching and leadership development services, which we did for free, to the campaign. We got to come to this evening and meet him, and as you read, I also had a slight distraction because I was having trouble keeping my eye on the ball in that particular evening, which is another way we get in our own way. But at least now I do have a picture of myself and my sister with the president, you know, sitting in our office. And it's a reminder that, you know, we try to, in our work, serve in many different ways. And we spend time, a lot of time, with business people and helping them fulfill their business aspirations. But, you know, doing public sector work and serving the government, serving your country, doing other kinds of nonprofit organizational work, that's a different kind of balance. But it's an important one in order to have meaning over time.
It is. Well, it's a fun story to end things on. We thank you for joining us this morning. Our guest is...
Thank you so much for reading the book. I'm happy I was your plane reader.
You know, I do have to end on this, too. The guy sitting... And I kid you not, this is a true story. Last night, coming back, the guy sitting in the seat next to me across the aisle said, oh, are you reading that book? And he's on his iPhone. I'm thinking checking email or whatnot. But he's also, Erica, reading your book on iBooks. Where I do have to make a plug for you, I would recommend that because he had videos to go along with the text.
Oh, yeah, that's the enhanced ebook.
He sprung for the enhanced.
Where we record exercises after each chapter. I'm there saying, now you come to the end of this chapter, here's an exercise you can do to build your skill. I also endorse the enhanced ebook.
Well,
it has great exercises.
There you go. That was a great endorsement for you. So obviously the word is getting out. Our guest is Erica Ariel Fox. She teaches negotiation at Harvard Law School. Her new book is Winning from Within, a breakthrough method for leading, living, and lasting change. Erica, thank you again. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. Have a good rest of your day.
Great. All right. And you're listening to Mound Money. We'll be back in a moment. Our guest is going to be Susan McTerran, and she is the Associate Dean of Graduate Programs for Quinnipiac University School of Business. And she's going to talk with us about Janet Yellen's recent nomination to be the chief of the Federal Reserve. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW. Stay tuned.
Hola, soy Jorge, uno de los anfitriones de Cada Domingo. Escuche Cada Domingo en KPCW 91.9 FM todos los domingos en las tardes de las 7 a las 10 p.m. Tenemos música, información de la comunidad y perdidos y encontrados. Por favor, denle like o me gusta a la página Facebook de Cada Domingo. Cada Domingo, solo en Park City, solo KPCW. Hi, I'm Jorge, one of the hosts for KPCW's Cada Domingo. You can hear Cada Domingo every Sunday evening on KPCW 91.9 FM from 7 to 10 p.m., where you can hear music, community information, and lost and founds. Please like the KPCW Cada Domingo Facebook page. Cada Domingo, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Tune in to KPCW every Tuesday morning at 9 to hear This Green Earth.
We'll cover environmental issues from local to global, from snowpack to giant squid,
geothermal energy to gray wolves,
and honeybees to sustainable chocolate. Brought to you by Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough,
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanities Restore,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
Okay, so we're back from break, and our next guest is Susan McTiernan. Susan is the Associate Dean for Graduate Programs in the Quinnipiac University School of Business. And the topic we're going to be talking about this morning is the decision to replace Ben Bernanke with the first female to lead the Federal Reserve. So, Susan, pretty exciting time in the Federal Reserve. What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, good morning. It certainly is a very exciting time. This is certainly one of those watershed moments in the history of women in leadership positions and women in the employment and workforce here in the United States. And it's one more of those events that I think will be noted in the future, along with the appointment of women to lead organizations like IBM and Pepsi. So we are all looking forward to a positive outcome for Dr. Yellen's appointment and the final resolution of the her ascendance to the chairing the Federal Reserve. It's a very exciting time for women in the workforce to consider the possibilities for themselves in light of someone ascending to this position, which many argue is the most powerful position in the world, controlling monetary policy for the U.S.
So, Susan, you're on the radio with us, but it's so behind the mic on our end is are two white males, right?
Okay.
And I do have a fair number of buddies that say, is this really still an issue? And, you know, as a father of two daughters, and Ted's the father of, I think Carly's about to be 10, if she's not 10 yet, Ted's a father of a daughter as well. It's an issue that's really important to me. And unfortunately, I think there still is, it's not talked about, it's not polite to talk about, but there still is this issue. We had Larry Warren and I, my normal co-host, had a guest on a year ago from the University of Utah, a PhD, and they took these executive summaries of how a CEO was running a company, and all they did was they changed the CEO's name maybe from Eric to Erica or from Chris to Christine. And then asked the students to rank the performance of the CEO, and the performance was dramatically lower for the female profile than it was the male profile. Why do you think that is in 2013? Why are we still struggling with this?
Well, it is a little scary that in 2013 there are still so many firsts of the type that Janet Yellen's appointment represents, but it is really a reality, and the kind of research that you mention is fairly commonplace. It sounds like a very interesting exercise, but there is other research that has been done to suggest that there are still ongoing prejudices against women, particularly in leadership roles. And the research that has been done that actually has looked at the number of women who serve in leadership roles can be even a little bit more frightening, considering the number of women in the workforce when half the workforce is effectively female, and the number of women receiving college degrees is significantly higher than it has ever been. The number of women in graduate professional schools is also higher than it has ever been. Yet when we look at studies done by organizations like Catalyst, based in New York, and the ION network of researchers who consider the number of women who are on corporate boards or who are among the most highly compensated officers of publicly traded organizations, those numbers always come in at less than 20%. And so we're not making a lot of progress on this, and some of those percentages, depending on the area of the country, can be as low as in the 8 or 9% range for the reporting that's done on an annual basis. So we're making a little bit of progress, but the progress is awfully slow, and it's not something that is confined even to the United States. It is something that is a problem and a challenge worldwide. Europe recently has undertaken some efforts to ensure leadership roles for women among boards of companies, and right now Norway leads the way with about 40% of their corporate boards being comprised of women. But there's a lot of speculation in terms of why it's still the case that women have difficulty, and the study that you mentioned certainly points to some of those difficulties that are directly prejudicial against women. There was another study last year that came out that removed all of the baggage that's sometimes attached to the arguments around why women can't advance as much as their male colleagues can, things like needing to get off the executive track to raise a family, needing to be home with their children, needing to take time off for a variety of other things, caring for aging parents, etc. But there was a study done last year of individuals, young women and young men, who had just graduated from college, where none of those things factored into the equation because they were just starting their careers. And still, even the salary differential between those individuals was considerable. It was about 15% to 20% of a salary differential between what the men were offered in their first career position and what the women were offered in their first career position. And the research was adjusted to account for traditionally higher paying jobs like those in computer science and finance, as opposed to those that tend to be lower paying in things like education and social services. So that was a pretty powerful study to show us that there are still gaps, even in the very early years of individuals' careers.
Yeah, so on the subject of computer science, I was in the Bay Area this weekend and was listening to the NPR station out in the Bay Area, which is a much bigger market, but I got to say KPCW does just as well. And they had a guest on from Google, from the HR department. They were talking about, you know, the challenges that Google has hiring women computer science graduates. And the challenge is so large that Google is now really addressing this issue at the front door. And they're really focusing a lot of efforts on, they have certain universities they tend to hire from, whether they're male or female, but on getting more females in the front doors of those universities to study computer science. And think about that investment. I mean, that's 4 to 6 years from the time they're doing their programs to encourage women to get into, in their case, computer science, until they're going to see any benefits. And that just shows the depth of the problem.
That's a good example of the depth of the problem, particularly with regard to those industries that are so based on the West Coast, those high-tech areas, and Google is a great example. But there's still a gross underrepresentation of women in fields like computer science when you look at university enrollments across the board. I know at my institution, we have a very small representation of women in computer science and in information services and information technology programs, and it's a constant battle to consider have women consider those particular majors because they seem to turn away and think they're too male-focused and male-centric. There won't be careers for them out there. They won't be able to succeed in that kind of an environment that is so largely male when they get out of their degree program. But, of course, as you point out, there are careers there, and there are organizations that have really taken steps to welcome women into those organizations, and the talent wars among organizations like Google Microsoft and organizations that really are dependent on women who are highly educated in the computer science area, those are significant challenges for those companies, and they have gone to great lengths in many cases to enable women to kind of marry their careers with their interest in starting families and have been successful in doing that. There are other organizations that have also done a wonderful job of providing mentorship for women, enabling them to have individuals who at more senior levels in the organization can be sought out for advice and for counsel at any point within their employment in the organization. Very, very favorable family leave benefits for women who want to start families, et cetera. So there are ways of attracting women and engaging women, and bringing those women who have the computer science skills into the organization is one part of the challenge. The other part of the challenge is getting those women to enroll in those computer science and information technology programs in the first place. And they're two slightly different challenges, but they both are things that certainly need our attention and need our attention more quickly than anybody probably thinks.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And what gives me hope is this is a solvable problem. Mm-hmm. And I think the first step and the most important step is all of us recognizing that, yes, it is 2013, but studies like what we shared earlier, the professor from the University of Utah did, mm-hmm. with changing the profile from male to female, mm-hmm. and seeing that difference, it is still an issue. And I think we all as a society have to admit it is an issue, and we're going to keep working on it. Susan, we thank you for joining us this morning. Our guest is Susan McTernan. She is the Associate Dean for Graduate Programs in the Quinnipiac University School of Business. It was a pleasure talking to you this morning.
It was a pleasure talking with you, too. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KCPW, and we'll be back in a moment. Our guest after break are going to be Kirsten Zuger and Alicia Moran. They are running a Fresh Day Cafe at the Rite Aid store here in Park City, and we'll be back in a moment to hear more from them.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Do you know that members of the Park City Chamber Bureau have access to a wide array of benefits that give them an edge in the local marketplace? We offer members-only insurance and discount programs, business-to-business networking opportunities, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Park City Realty Group is proud to support KPCW. Park City Realty Group has provided real estate services to buyers and sellers since 2005. Our team shares local knowledge and insight with clients who value the Park City lifestyle. Knowledge plus hard work equals success. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Okay. Welcome back to KPCW. Our next guest here on Mountain Money is a couple of our friends from the Fresh Day Cafe at Rite Aid. We've got Kirsten Zuger and Alicia Moran. And tell us a little bit about why Rite Aid decided to open a cafe.
I think that Rite Aid just wanted to try to expand their grocery a little bit further, and luckily they decided to choose Park City as the very first one. So far so good. We've been open for about a week and a half, and everything's been running pretty well.
So what are you doing to let folks know, besides coming on to, you know, big time radio shows like this to talk about what you're doing? What other things do you have cooking over there that you're using, you know, social media or traditional advertising to let folks know why they ought to come to Rite Aid?
Yes, we did a lot of traditional advertising with the new newspaper, trying to keep it local as well. We did have a grand reopening for Rite Aid, so we really tried to advertise that and spread the word around town that we had this going on. Last week was our grand reopening, and it went pretty well. You know, we had a ribbon cutting. We're introducing a lot of things with Rite Aid. We have a bunch of new positions available. We have a wellness ambassador, which is basically someone just walking around and asking you questions and, you know, trying to help you find things. We completely remodeled our store and made it a lot easier shopping for our customers. And the cafe, of course, is wonderful because why go anywhere else when you have your prescriptions waiting for you? Walk up front, get some coffee, have some pastries and some hand-dipped yogurt or ice cream with some frozen yogurt. And it's all good.
So speaking of the wellness person, where I thought you were going to go with that is I know there's a trend now to have some basic level medical care provided through drugstores. I was in California. My daughter thought she had strep throat. We were trying to figure out where to go. And it turns out, Ted, you can go to the Walgreens and they have a nurse practitioner there and get a strep test. And fortunately, she didn't have strep throat. Mm-hmm. But is Rite Aid doing that yet? Is that something that's on their horizon that you know of?
We're slowly introducing things. Rite Aid's really trying to keep up with the times. You know, Walgreens and CVS does have the minute clinics, as you would call it. You walk in, see a nurse. We do have our pharmacists on duty at all times. And the wellness ambassador is to help with those medical care needs and those questions. And they will bring you back to the pharmacist and any questions that you may have. Our pharmacists are readily available to consult at all times, and we're working on it. We'll see where it goes as far as the minute clinics, but not as of yet.
Good. And tell us about the cafe. What are you guys supper? Can you do lunch? What's kind of your type of food that you're serving there?
So for now, the cafe is serving coffee bean and tea leaf coffee, which is out of LA, and it's the very first one in all of Utah. So it's having a really great feedback. Everybody's really excited about coffee bean and tea leaf.
I know I'm excited to walk up.
I have to admit this, Ted. You're probably much hipper than I am, but coffee, tea, and bean leaf. What is that?
Coffee bean and tea leaf. It's just a brand of coffee. I mean, sort of like Starbucks or
got it. Okay.
Java or
I thought instead
that.
Of you know drinking from the coffee bean, we're now using the leaf or something. Every part is used now.
No, it's a coffee bean.
It's a brand.
And tea
okay.
leaf.
Okay.
So it's just coffees and teas.
Got it.
And they're wonderful. And coffee bean and tea leaf actually makes their coffee with powders instead of syrups. So there's actually dairy in those powders, and it makes it a lot creamier and not so sweet to me. We also have pastries that are also out of California, Galaxy, Juniors, and Chef's Line. And so there's lots of breakfast pastries as well as like spinach feta croissant to have like something a little lunchy.
Right.
We're getting some flatbread sandwiches in the next, I think, 2 weeks probably. And we also have Thrifty Frozen Yogurt, which is Rite Aid's very own brand of yogurt and ice cream. There's Thrifty ice cream hand-dipped. So the coffee, the pastries, the frozen yogurt and the ice cream is currently what's at the cafe.
You know, it's interesting that you mention a couple of those products are from California. One of the things that I think folks are seeing a lot is buy local. So how did Rite Aid think about buy local versus importing some of these products from California? Obviously, we have a lot of California visitors in here during the busy parts of the year, but how'd you think about that? Or is this just a national rollout and you had to go with the national products?
Well, as far as the Thrifty is Rite Aid's ice cream and frozen yogurt. That's done out of California. They make it in their warehouse or whatever. And so that comes here from there. And as far as the cafe, this is the first one. So they are going to be spreading it. The next one's in Beverly Hills and so on and so forth.
Wow, first Park City, then Beverly Hills.
Right?
Wow.
We're up there.
Very cool.
So from there, I think that they just kind of wanted to make everything like as accessible to everybody everywhere, no matter where they expand to this.
So you've got a real challenge as the first store, the first Rite Aid to have this. Maybe as the manager of the store, what challenges are you looking at in terms of this rollout to make sure that you set the proper example?
Yeah, the pressure's on.
Yeah.
The pressure is on, you know. We're just really focused on quality and making this easy for our customers. And, you know, a lot of people do like to go local, and we had talked about that, but like you had mentioned, it is a corporate rollout at the moment. So we're trying what is easiest for us at the time, and then we'll go from there and try to buy into more local and, you know, we'll see how it goes.
I love that answer, though, right? First is quality, because if the food's got to be good, obviously, mm-hmm. right?
Of course. Then
focus on the customer. And if you get those two things right, you'll probably be wildly
Absolutely.
Successful with it.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for coming in this morning. Our guests are Kristen Zuger and Alicia Moran from the Fresh Day Cafe at the Rite Aid. Very interesting. Nationwide, the first cafe inside a Rite Aid.
Yep.
Up next, Beverly Hills. That's probably the order things should be going in the country
Absolutely.
Here. Good luck with that, and thank you for joining
us
this morning.
Thank you, guys. Thanks.
You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mound Money. Really fascinating conversation today. Really enjoyed the negotiation discussion. I want to start off by thanking our great sponsors on Mound Money. We couldn't do this show without you. We appreciate your support. Park City Realty Group, Mound West Bank, Iron Mound Group, Park City Chamber, Prudential Utah Real Estate, and San Francisco Designs. Thank all of you for your support of the station. We couldn't do great shows like this without you. So, Ted, that first off, you had to be smiling there. As a Harvard alum yourself, having the author come in and talk to us from Harvard, not only a graduate of Harvard, but teaches at Harvard as well.
Yeah, you know, it was neat to read her book prior to getting on the show, just reviewing some of the things that she's got in there. And I love simple frameworks. And one of the things I think that Harvard's really good at is making it simple. Because,
they have to keep it simple for those guys there, I guess.
Exactly. The Stanford guys are a little sharper than the Harvard guys. But, you know, the one takeaway I had from that it reminded me of a conversation I heard last week from one of the leaders that I work with oftentimes at USTAR, and his comment was, you know, write more emails than you send. And why do I think that's relevant? You know, because I think it's important that before you just react, and today with email and Facebook and LinkedIn and all kinds of things, I think that there's a lot of us that have the ability to quickly react.
Yep.
And, what this book taught us today is, be a little bit more reflective. Think about those four inner selves.
Yep.
And if you're the person that has, usually is a quick reactor, maybe you should write more emails than you send and even sleep on it from time to time.
I haven't heard that before. That's good advice. Ted, you mentioned USTAR. You're the executive director at USTAR. Take a couple, which is a heck of a program. And one of the things I really like about the state of Utah is we have a number of initiatives to really move the needle and help businesses. Last week I was ragging on Washington and saying how they're making it more difficult. I think Utah's just the opposite. I think Utah does a lot of great things to help small businesses. USTAR is one of those. Tell us what USTAR does.
Yeah, so USTAR is the Utah Science, Technology, and Research Initiative, and it was conceived as a visionary long-term program to grow the state's innovation capacity. And really what we do is we try to promote innovation at the University of Utah, Utah State, and the regional higher education institutions. We help faculty members who develop intellectual property or have a eureka moment to be able to understand whether there's actually a market opportunity for their eureka moment. And if we determine that there is a way to bring that innovation or technology to market, then we help them with the business planning process, help them to seek the capital, and try to bring together the entrepreneurs, the innovators, the financial capital community, and the people that can actually sell the product into the market.
Right. And we've seen the results of a couple of your scientists that have had business ideas, and you've helped them hook up with the right business people to say, here's a business, and maybe we can launch it and raise some money. And I've had a chance to see them present, and some of their ideas and some of their businesses are really quite spectacular.
Well, thanks. We're super excited about a couple of our projects. We've got this storm project at Utah State University that just continues to get great news, and really looking forward to announcing the rollout of Storm. And keep your eyes open at the University of Utah, because the electric bus will be running at the University of Utah in the next 2 weeks.
And that's really a fabulous innovation there. It turns out electric buses are totally doable from a technology standpoint. The problem is the battery weighs so much it can't carry passengers. And Ted, your group of scientists and UStar helping them has helped solve that. So keep an eye out for the electric bus. Well, great show this morning. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM, Mound Money. And stay tuned for NPR News.